Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the first of this year's University Colloquium events. One of the primary purposes of the University Colloquium series is to encourage campus-wide conversation across boundaries that we often don't cross in our everyday lives. And I can hear from the buzz that we're already succeeding at our purpose before we even have the presentation. Sorry to interrupt your conversations, but appreciate your being here. Our speaker today will be familiar to many of you if you've been here at EMU for any length of time, but for those of you who are new and for those of you who've been around and maybe haven't gotten to know Dave real well, let me go over some of his basic facts. Dave Brubaker has been on the faculty here at EMU since, and let me make sure I get this right, since 2004. But he actually has a long career in both the academy and in applied work with a variety of organizations. He did his bachelor's work at Messiah College in business administration, graduated in 1980. We won't hold that against him. They're a competitor school, but friendly competitors. And then went and served with Mennonite Central Committee for 3 or 4 years in the 1980s in Brazil, where he learned to speak Portuguese and worked in Recife in Brazil. And I'm sure the language training came in handy during his sabbatical in Mozambique and Angola. He did an MBA at Eastern University in 1992. So he's been kind of circling around all of our major competitors. We're glad he ended up here. After that, did some consulting work and other kinds of work with a variety of community organizations. And then came here to EMU, joined CJP in 2004, near the end of his graduate work at University of Arizona, and finished up his dissertation and graduated with a PhD from Arizona in sociology in 2007. Picked a particularly fine discipline. He's done all the good scholarly stuff, has several books, a number of articles on his CV. I won't read through all those titles, but I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you about them after the talk. Today he's going to be talking to us about his sabbatical work last year, his research in Mozambique and Angola. And I know I'm really looking forward to hearing this comparative analysis of peace building in these two countries in Southern Africa. Dave, welcome, and thanks.
Well, it's great to see so many colleagues here and students from CJP. Thank you. And also, my son Everett is one of the few undergrad students who managed to make it, so thank you very much. I know they don't promote it to undergrad students particularly, but thank you all for coming. Wanted to make just one comment about a sabbatical and then go into my presentation on the research. I was very grateful after 7 years here to have a sabbatical, so thank you to Fred and the committee who made that decision. Thank you especially to my colleagues, because having covered for other colleagues' sabbaticals, I know that it adds to the workload for those left behind. So thank you very much for doing that. I have about 24 slides, and I'm planning to do it in about 30 minutes, leaving 30 minutes, hopefully, for your comments and questions, and particularly want to look at the role of religious peacebuilding in this country or whatever your country of origin might be. Fred already took a bit of my introduction, so I don't need to repeat that I spent some time in Brazil, and Mert and I were there for 3 years, learned Portuguese along the way. That enabled me to be able to do some training in Mozambique and Angola with Search for Common Ground and with UNICEF back in the 90s. At that time, Mozambique was coming out of war, and Angola was spiraling back into it. The war in Mozambique ended in 92 with a peace agreement and stayed over. So it's about 20 years of peace. The war in Angola supposedly ended in 91 with a peace agreement negotiated by the UN, but unfortunately returned to violence and didn't end until 2002. I was curious as to why, and the research sabbatical gave me a chance to visit both countries again and talk with leaders in both countries about that experience of war and peace. Most of you probably know where Angola and Mozambique lie, but southwest and southeastern coast of Africa, unfortunately very close to South Africa, and both were considered frontline states during the period of apartheid. You can see why in the case of Mozambique, bordering as it does South Africa. Angola at the time bordered a country that was known as Southwest Africa, later Namibia, where South African troops were present, and so was also considered a frontline country. I began my research with this question, really looking at the literature and asking, what are the factors that fuel violent civil conflict? So I'd love to hear some of your hypotheses, if you could just throw them out from where you are. What seemed to propel a country into a violent civil conflict? What are the factors? Power struggles, okay? Other thoughts? Ideology, I think I heard. Colonialism was where you were going. Others? Yes, especially when it's manipulated for political ends, ethnic differences. Testosterone is one contribution. Known in the literature as young men with guns, but yeah. And economic disparity. Excellent. So I'll quickly go through some of the things that appear in the research on this topic. Economic is indeed a huge issue, not just poverty. Interestingly, absolute poverty does make a very big difference. If a country has a per capita income of only $500 per year, they have a 15% likelihood of violent conflict within the next 5 years. As it goes up to 10 times that, it drops to almost nothing. Financial support, though, also matters. So during the Cold War, the financial support of the major powers, particularly the U.S. and the Soviet Union, as I think Catherine has said, the war was only cold in the Northern Hemisphere. It was very hot in other parts of the world, and that was because of the financial support of the major powers. The diaspora, those who have spread around the world from a country in conflict, can also provide financial support, and tragically, blood diamonds and other forms of mineral resources can make a difference. Political differences we talked about. The invasion of Iraq, which was a dictatorship, by the U.S. and Great Britain and others, which were democracies, in 2003 was actually quite an anomaly. Normally, democracies do not invade dictatorships. Dictatorships do have a higher likelihood, however, of going to war internally or with others. Weaker failed states like Somalia, we can certainly see the presence of that kind of internal conflict. And political leadership, both of the government and the rebel leaders, has been studied as one factor in promoting civil conflict, or for that matter, peace. And finally, identity threats were mentioned, particularly again when manipulated for political gain, both ethnic and religious. It's important to realize what's going on now, I think, in terms of legitimizing ideologies, how people will use Islam, Christianity, Judaism for political purposes, not that in and of themselves they are causing war. History and geography. If you've experienced a civil conflict within the last 5 years, you have double the likelihood of again experiencing a civil conflict. So history matters, and of course geography, the factor of contagion, being close to a country experiencing civil conflict, as in West Africa, we saw it bounced around from Liberia, where Lima Boy is from, to other countries in that part of West Africa. And of course, environmental, increasingly in the literature, both in terms of global climate change and the wars over water. So we see a number of reasons why countries might fall into civil conflict. What isn't written much about in the literature, except the last decade, some work that Catherine and others have done, is the role of civil society. So to define it, what is civil society? It's that space between the government, the elites we sometimes think of them as, and the grassroots, the individuals and families who make up the grassroots of a society. We see it expressed primarily in organizations, in universities, in NGOs, nonprofit organizations, and also community-based organizations that exist throughout the world. Interesting research by St. John and Kew, looking at the role of civil society in peace building in this literature that's starting to come out. They studied 25 cases, found that 12 of those cases they ranked as relatively high, moderate to high, in the involvement of civil society in the peace-building process. 13 they ranked as relatively low. Then they looked at outcomes. 10 of the 13 resumed war within 5 years. 10 of the 13 cases where civil society did not have a significant presence fell back into war within 5 years. Of the 12 where civil society did have a significant presence, 10 of the 12 did not experience renewed hostility, and all of the cases they ranked as high in civil society involvement managed to sustain peace for at least 5 years, which is how this is measured. So we know that civil society makes a difference, and probably the most significant player for many of us within civil society would be religious figures, religious leaders, but others who make up the religious community. So what can we say about religious leaders? Our colleague Hiskia Sasefa says that religion offers a very important space because it deals with the affective and not just the cognitive. Religious actors also themselves are often well known within civil society, at least at the local level and often at the regional and national level as well. And this one I think is critical. Religious institutions tend to survive when other institutions of civil society break down, or for that matter in a dictatorship are suppressed. So why is it that we sometimes see protests coming out of mosques on Fridays in a given part of the world? That's the only place left for civil society voices to be heard. Everything else has been suppressed. Likewise, in a country like Mozambique and Angola, after 15 years of revolutionary war, 10 to 20 years of civil war, one of the few functioning parts of the society left were the churches and mosques in those two countries. So I want to give you a bit of a background on these two countries before sharing the research that I did. And as we go through this, you'll see that by and large, they start out with comparable histories in terms of settlement patterns, Portuguese colonialism, and don't get me started on Portuguese colonialism. All colonialism is evil. Portuguese colonialism, I think, was particularly evil in Africa because it was so extractive. There was not much of an effort to put in any infrastructure, as we saw in some parts of Africa. So the first couple of paragraphs are pretty similar. It starts to diverge by the third and fourth paragraphs, and for the simple reason, as I said earlier, a peace agreement ended the war in Mozambique in 1992. A peace agreement appeared to end the war in Angola in 1991, but war resumed, and it didn't end until Jonas Savimbi was killed by government troops 10 years later in 2002. So you see that it makes a difference in terms of democratic outcomes as well. We could look around the world, by the way, where war has ended because of violence. Sri Lanka, where the opposition leaders are killed, compared to countries like Northern Ireland, South Africa, Mozambique, where the war ends with some sort of negotiated peace agreement. And I'm convinced it makes a significant difference in terms of long-term outcomes as well. So I had to ask the question, why the difference? And this is the last slide I'll give you from the literature. Interesting hypotheses as I was reading about Mozambique and Angola. You see the Angolan flag on the right-hand side. It looks like a hammer and sickle. It's actually a machete and a cog from industry. But they are often seen as a little more hardline Marxist than is Mozambique. And that's one of the hypotheses as to a different outcome. A second, also related to the political struggle, was that Savimbi, the rebel leader in Angola, refused to accept the outcome of the elections in his country in 92, whereas the rebel leader in Mozambique, Dhlakama, did, and of course, the country did not fall back into war. The Cold War, for whatever reason, probably oil, the major powers were more interested in Angola than they were in Mozambique, and so they provided more financial assistance, kept the war going longer. This one is a classic in the literature. What does Angola have in addition to oil? Diamonds. The government controlled the oil, the rebels controlled the diamonds. What does Mozambique have? Beautiful country, but not resource rich, thus overlooked. And finally, some writers argue that Angola experienced ongoing conflict because the ethnic divisions were more clear-cut, and there was a little more of a parallel between the rebel forces and the government and ethnic differences in Angola than there was in Mozambique. But most writers do not attribute this to ethnicity in either case. That's what the literature says, and since I forced my research design students to do a lit review, I thought I'd ask you to sit through one as well. Let me move on to original research and talk about what I found. These were the methods that I chose to use. Basically, face-to-face interviews with about 20 participants, which I'll talk about. Also, participant observation, it's wonderful to be in a country and see what's happening post-war. This is Luanda, the capital city of Angola. There are construction cranes everywhere. The combination of oil money in Angola and unemployment in Europe has brought many European firms and workers, unfortunately, to Angola, so that there's less local employment than there should be, but things are booming. Sandra Kinitz, who's here from Brazil, translated and transcribed all of these interviews. I'm very grateful to her. Somehow she was able to sit in front of the computer and listen to it in Portuguese and type it in English at the same time, something that I could not have done. And the literature review, with the results of which you just saw. Let me talk briefly about the participants in this study. And I'm going to start with Mozambique. Some of the faces might be familiar to some of you, particularly our student Alfiata Zunguza, who's in the center, lower level there of the pictures. But I also talked with Angelina Neves from UNICEF, Denise Matsolo, a Methodist bishop, Denise Singolani, an Anglican bishop, Boaventura Zita, who is from the Christian Council of Mozambique, Jacinta Jorge, and João Montembeni. And the three Muslim participants that you see pictured were Sheikh Abdul Karim, Nuruddin Sal, and Abin Mohammed. Fascinating folks, and all of them gave me permission to record their picture as well as their words. I was a little less successful in Angola because two participants did not want their names or pictures used, one of which was a woman, so it appears that this was an all-male group. But here you'll see Augusto Chipezi, who's with the Congregational Church, Antonio Musaki, head of the Evangelical Alliance of Angola, Bernardo Ingunza, an Anglican bishop, Gaspar Domingos, a Methodist bishop, Deolinda Dorcas, the person not pictured, with the World Council of Churches, and José Antonio, who's with the Reformed Church, and one Mennonite, the fellow with the notebook in front of him, is Noé Alberto José, who works with the Council of Churches in Angola. Wonderful folks with very rich stories, and so I want to share a little bit of that. When I went through several research classes at the University of Arizona, they said we also have to be keenly aware of who we are as the researcher, so I thought I would review a couple of points that are relevant to my identity and this research. Being European American, I wondered if it would be there would be an opening to my presence in Mozambique and Angola. There was. Being male turned out to be okay with most of the participants, and the three women that I interviewed also seemed open to participating. Being Mennonite was an asset, somewhat to my surprise. In Mozambique, Mennonite Central Committee has had a significant presence over the years, and in Angola, there are three Mennonite church bodies. So in both cases, Mennonites were well-known and respected. Being a professor was also an asset because most folks were very happy to talk to a professor from an American university for a variety of reasons, but it turned out to be an open door. I had to ask if they would indeed talk with me openly. I'm convinced that the reason, primary reason, was not my identity, but the fact that I worked with gatekeepers, our student from Mozambique, as I mentioned earlier, and also the head of the Council of Churches in Angola, Luis Ngimbi, who has been here for SPI. So the combination of a CJP alum in Mozambique and an SPI alum in Angola opened a lot of doors. What did I find? Some of you might recognize this. This is a Wordle, where you can dump a lot of transcripts into a free computer online program and get the results according to the frequency with which the word is mentioned. So when I asked about the causes of conflict in Mozambique, it was pretty clear. People saw the primary cause as South Africa. And if you know the history of Mozambique and their destabilization efforts throughout the apartheid period, it makes sense. There's no question. I expected to see something about the US and the Soviet Union, hardly showed up at all in Mozambique. In Angola, it was different. South Africa is there, but the words are very small. You won't see them. What are significant are the names of the three political parties that were involved. They very much saw it as an internal fight among the MPLA, which is the government party, and two rebel movements, the FNLA and, most famously, UNITA. So people had different diagnoses for what was causing their conflict. And by the way, the word church in Angola is not an accident. That was also mentioned as a major contributor to the conflict, because the three regions that these three movements came from had been settled and had missionary activity from three different American churches, three different denominations. And a surprising number of respondents blamed their differing, albeit Christian, but differing denominational affiliation for the conflict, as well as the personalities of the three leaders themselves. How did the war affect you personally? This question, I realized after I had asked it about 18 times, also started to affect me, because everybody had a story. So if you can imagine, of the 19 persons that I interviewed directly, the 20th interview came from a colleague, but of the 19 persons I interviewed directly, 12 of them had lost family members, described by them as cousins, uncles, aunts, family members in the way we would think of extended family. A number talked about losing dreams. When your country's at war for 30 or 40 years, a lot gets lost. And it was education, the hope for a stable life, dreams for their family and children that were lost. Many became a refugee because of the war, and all of those who suffered hunger were from Mozambique, interestingly, and all of those who suffered persecution were from Angola. So there were somewhat different experiences in those two countries. I asked them about factors that led to an outcome, and these were different outcomes. Again, it was successful in Mozambique. It was not successful in Angola. So I was very interested in what were the differing reasons for this. And the Angolan respondents were extremely critical of the international community, and particularly the UN. Not only had they excluded civil society from the peace process in 91, but it had felt very rushed to them, that as they watched it from the outside, they were not able to participate, and they were not able to slow it down. Lack of trust, which we see in almost any failed negotiation process, and of course, Savimbi's decision to go back to war was blamed. Many faulted their own lack of a democratic conscience after centuries of colonialism and decades of revolution and civil war. One person, and one person only, happened to be the Mennonite fellow, pointed to the absence of civil society in Angola. Why did it succeed in Mozambique? The people wanted peace was what I most heard. That was mentioned by nearly every one of the nine persons that I interviewed directly in Mozambique. Political and religious leadership was given a lot of credit as well. And here we see the combination, the importance of the combination of political leaders working with civil society leaders. So President Chissano in Mozambique was highly praised because he was willing to take risks for peace, as were the leaders, particularly two archbishops, one Anglican, one Catholic, who themselves took risks for peace by reaching out to RENAMO, the opposition, and bringing them to the table. Lack of natural resources, the fact that they don't have oil and diamonds, and a relatively healthy negotiation process, which, by the way, lasted 2 years in Rome, hosted by the Sant'Egidio community, and involved 10 sessions. So this was not a single sit-down with the UN, knock heads together. It was an ongoing process. And reintegration efforts took place in Mozambique much more than in Angola. A very famous Armas para Enxadas program, or Arms to Hose in English, where people were encouraged to turn in their small arms and have them converted actually into a variety of sculptures or melted down, and then were given hoes to farm with in exchange, made a huge difference in the ongoing violence rate in Mozambique, which is significantly lower than that in Angola. This fellow is often known as the Archbishop Tutu of Mozambique, and I know that Carl and Carolyn know him as well. This is Bishop Denis Singolani, wonderful fellow, incredibly wise. He probably deserves more credit than any single human being for bringing the parties to the table in Mozambique, but he shares it very broadly. So when I was talking to him, I was paying attention. What are your top reasons for the success of this process in Mozambique? And notice he went right to the resource curse. Thank God, if Mozambique has any resources, we don't know about it. And in Angola, this is sobering for those of us who see ourselves as doing sometimes professional peacebuilding work. In Angola, the process was professionalized, and in Mozambique, it was locally owned. And he believes that's a big part of the reason. I want to read something to you on that point. This is directly from the transcript of his interview, so Sandra will recognize this. Bishop Singolani, some of us had the feeling that the answer to the problem of war came through dialogue. We were a minority with a timid voice, and this voice didn't develop from one moment to the other. It took time to externalize. And when it came out, more people joined the idea. The official discourse and everything around it led people to think that the only solution were with arms. But we came to the conclusion and felt that the people that killed and were killed were Mozambicans. Therefore, the matter needed to be solved by the Mozambicans themselves. The only thing that came from outside, listen to this, the only thing that came from outside were the arms and the ideology. How do you translate apartheid or communism in Jangana? The ideas couldn't be translated because they came from outside. Now, who is key for it all? It's the Mozambicans, and it's them who needed to talk and dialogue. And when we started to think about it, this was the logic, and we shared these ideas with each other. We saw that we needed to convince other people that the way to peace was dialogue. That was the approach of the Christian Council of Mozambique, to talk to the government and ask them, why don't you go and talk to the others? But the reaction was, I won't go. I don't hang out with these people. And we ended up giving in and not insisting. The attitude of the Christian Council of Mozambique was pastoral. Both groups were needing a more prophetic attitude, and so we ended up saying, they need to talk to the others. Why don't you go now and talk to the others? Their own evolution in peace building. And this was the final piece that made some sense to me, that the CCME, as it's called, the Christian Council of Mozambique, took a very strong stance that their priests, their pastors, their ministers could not advocate for any political position in the run-up to the elections and in the subsequent years after that in 92. They could speak to the issues and they could advocate for peace, but they could not be partisan in their advocacy and dialogue. So I want to conclude with questions for us in this society, because we also live in a deeply divided country, and religion is a source of conflict as well as a resource for peace in this setting. These are my conclusions, and I'd like to spend our last 30 minutes in some conversation with you all about them. But first of all, members of civil society, including religious leaders, must be included in the peace-building process. That will certainly look differently here in the States or in Canada than it did in Mozambique or Angola. But we have to be present for these debates and dialogue. The problem is, when religious leaders completely identify with one political party, they lose the ability to serve as impartial facilitators or arbiters of discussion and decision-making. That does not, in my opinion, negate the role of advocates and taking very clear positions on issues that matter to us, but it probably means when we choose to become an advocate, we are choosing not to stay in the role of impartial facilitator. There was tremendous effort in Angola to call the country to peace. They had prayers for peace in a stadium, a football stadium that seated about 80,000 people. They filled it up. But unfortunately, the prayers for peace alone did not bring the parties to the table nor keep them there. And there was something about the behind-the-scenes patient work that the Mozambican leaders did, along with praying for peace, that ultimately paid off. It also became clear, listening to me, that the Mozambican leaders had spent about 2 years building relationships to get the parties to the table, and then 2 years in Rome keeping them at the table and working with them. So this was a 4-year process of peace building that started with going under cover of darkness to the RENAMO headquarters in the bush and attempting to build a relationship with the head of RENAMO. Thus, they would say that peace building requires, at a minimum, risking one's reputation. It was amazing how much criticism some of the leaders got once it became public that they were engaged in outreach to the other side. In their case, certainly, they risked their lives as well. Some references for the literature review piece of this for your interest, but more importantly for our discussion. These are some questions that I have. I'd like to open it up to any comments that you would have or questions about this particular case study as well. But what are the ways in which religious leaders and lay people can contribute to peace building in this context or in your context if you're not from here? And how do we decide when it's the time to advocate and when it's the time to remain at least publicly impartial so that we're able to stay in the role of neutral if that's the desired role? Those are my questions. I'd welcome yours. And we've got 20 minutes at least for your response. So please take some time to think about your response to this or anything you'd want to frame back to me.
Thanks, Dave. It seems to me that one of the things that had to happen in Mozambique was actually self-change. The leaders, we've talked about this in the office a bit, they had to begin perceiving themselves differently and playing a different role, and that always takes time. I'm wondering what were the pressures on them to not take this kind of public political role? Were any of those theological about not engaging in that? Because I'm seeing that in Myanmar, that some of the religious leaders who could be more prophetic about peace are saying that's just not our role, right? I mean, we're about the coming kingdom, not about this one. So,
yeah, well, that would be a real temptation in a society that is that divided and violent to step out of it in some theological or psychological sense. But what Bishop Singolani said, what finally drove him to take the risk of approaching RENAMO and trying to get the parties together, was he could not go to another burial service. He said he had been going to them for 15 years, and he just couldn't do it. And he said, it'll be so much better for me to go and talk to Dalai Lama, even if I'm killed, than it would be to go to another church burial service.
Quick follow-up question. You said they had criticism. Were they saying criticism from inside the church, from the public in general, or both? And were there differences in the criticism?
Well, a million people died in both Mozambique and Angola, and many of the million that died in Mozambique were killed by RENAMO banditry attacks, they called them. RENAMO was despised in many parts of the country and seen as pure bandits, not as a legitimate civil war or civil fighting force. So to take the risk of talking to what many in southern Mozambique particularly saw as out-of-control, drug-addicted murderers, I mean, think about that. And yet they signed and kept a peace agreement. Oh, my colleagues are helping me out. Thank you.
Hi, Dave. Thanks. And just to give you the opportunity, really, to talk a little bit more about the Angolan religious leaders, because you talked a bunch about what the Mozambican religious leaders did, but I know that the Angolan religious leaders were also active. What characterized their involvement, and what are some of the distinctions and learning points could you derive from that?
Yeah, thank you for that. So the main difference between the Angolan leaders and the Mozambican leaders was that Angolan leaders organized a decade later for peace. So the Mozambican leaders began to organize in 1990. By 92, they had the parties at the table. The Angolan leaders trusted the UN, and they thought the process would hold. And they only realized in about 2000 that it wasn't going to work. And so they went to the government and said, can we have outreach to UNITA? Can we go into the bush and meet with them? And they actually got permission to do that. And I talked with an Anglican bishop again, who was one of four that went and talked with Jonas Savimbi in the bush, in November of 2001, left with what they thought was his permission to share that he would be willing to participate in peace talks. And 3 months later, he was dead, killed by government forces in February of 2002. So what was the primary difference between Mozambican church leaders and Angolan church leaders? A decade. They waited too long. They finally realized it was up to them to do it, but it was too late to have it settled peacefully before the war ended violently.
I'm wondering, Dave, and you can comment, just carrying on from the last question. My experience in Angola was that, as you had sort of alluded to, the church became much more toxically intertwined with the political parties. And I remember, you know, the council itself deeply divided about their ideological support of the current government and so on. So I wonder if that also was at play for how long it took them to get to the table.
Yeah, I didn't speak at length about this, but I'm writing about it right now. The Mozambican church leaders were rigorously impartial. And the Angolan church leaders, unfortunately, were co-opted by the various political parties. Again, the leaders of those three parties came from three regions where missionaries had established churches and where church people tended to be loyal to those political leaders. And they're not quite as self-critical about that as I expected, but I think it's as they reflect on the war years and how they were co-opted, there's a recognition that it happened very slowly over time. And I see a very similar trend in this country and other places. We're not co-opted by politicians overnight. It tends to take decades.
Well, thank you, Dave, for doing all of this research. Mm-hmm. It's very nice to see in retrospect what happened. I was wondering if, from what you've learned, if you know of a way that conflicts could be diagnosed in the moment to know these sorts of things as they're happening so that we know what needs to be done.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I have two colleagues here who teach conflict analysis courses, and that is designed indeed to help people to analyze conflicts in the moment. It is so much easier looking back and so much neater and so much cleaner, which is probably why research is appealing to some of us. It's not nearly as messy as real life. But even in real life, when I work with conflicted organizations, and about a third of my clients have been congregations the last 25 years, sometimes in extremely high-level conflict, and yes, there was a fistfight at one church that I worked with, not Mennonite, but in that high-level conflict, we still have to listen to people before making any recommendations about how to proceed. We have to listen to understand what are the issues, who are the key parties, what level of intensity is this conflict, what needs to be done at a systems level to try to make things better. So we do action research. It's on the fly, doing the listening and making recommendations as we enter the conflict. Now, if someone wants to give a better response to that, I'd welcome it.
Thank you, Dave. I was thinking about the South African sort of story in conjunction to these comparisons here. And I'm wondering, your personal response to that second piece that you have up there. In other words, in South Africa, we did have certainly church leaders who were interested in bringing parties together. However, they were also very partisan to a particular outcome. So they sort of mixed and matched. It wasn't that they were impartial totally, but on the other hand, they weren't sort of taken hostage to a maybe hostile outcome. So any reflections, any words of wisdom on that whole second piece up there?
Well, I'll give a personal reflection as opposed to words of wisdom. I realize when I look back at what I've posted on my own Facebook page over the last 2 years, that there are some issues that I care passionately about and I will take a public stand, if you will, one of which is immigration reform. And I realized it's because I spent 12 years in Arizona and I knew a lot of human beings who were deeply affected by that. And so I can't stay impartial. And I have a hunch that's how many of us make those decisions. Do we know human beings who are personally deeply affected by whatever the injustice is in the society? And if so, are we being called to speak out on it rather than remain publicly impartial to try to facilitate dialogue? And I would never fault another human being for making a different choice than I would make, because I think it's very personal and relational.
Can I push you a little bit on that? I agree with it. I like it. But wouldn't we all, who post whatever we post on Facebook, probably say the same thing? And isn't that part of the intensity of the division among us?
Well, that's hard to argue.
And I'm not asking you to solve that, but it's the knot that I don't know how to untie.
Right. So people feel passionate about a variety of issues in a variety of ways, and so we see more polarized discourse. But isn't that the nature of social media? Nobody is arbitrating these postings, so people are free to express their deepest fears and hopes. The one thing I'll say, I went to a family wedding in Ohio a couple weekends ago, and I have a cousin who's incredibly conservative, and I knew that from what he had been posting on Facebook, he and I were at different points of view on a number of issues, and I really wondered how it would be relating to him. And we avoided politics until Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. We were scheduled to leave at 3. So Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, he raised it. And I realized in talking to him that conversion attempts were meaningless, either him to convert me or me to convert him. So we decided to try to look for some common ground, and we actually found it on several issues. But it took an hour of dialogue with each other to identify that there were things such as the budget deficit in the United States that we both cared about.
This is kind of a question for Carolyn as well as you, Dave. I'm wondering if there's a way to be transcendently partial. In other words, you are advocating not for one party versus another party, but for a kind of a transcendent outcome that includes everybody. And I think that's what some of the South African leaders were particularly good at. That they said, this has to end, apartheid has to end. But that doesn't mean we're gonna kick all the white people out, right? And we're very clear about that. So I think religious leaders can be particularly good at expressing that kind of transcendent, inclusive goal. And then the other thing is that they can also be process advocates. Jim Lowy always used to talk about being a process advocate. I see Dave nodding because he knew Jim as well. So you're process partial rather than choosing a side.
Well, maybe it's about methodology too, and here's where I think our Anabaptist witness sets us apart. And for instance, in South Africa, we had the Inkatha Freedom Party saying that blood was gonna roll in the streets, and that's how they disagreed. And then you had the ANC, who towards the ending phases was much more reconciliation orientated. So maybe it's about methodology in terms of how we disagree.
And Martin Luther King's famous quote, if you refuse to negotiate with the moderates, you'll end up fighting the radicals.
Thank you. Just a follow-up on this theme. I'm wondering also how much you were able to tease out the distinctive role that the religious leaders were playing in Mozambique, because they were, in fact, playing a kind of a process mediator role. And in South Africa, the churches were actually deliberately not asked to play that role. In the National Peace Accords and other processes, they were very active in helping to convene the processes, but in part because they were seen as having a particular outcome that they were trying to, a particular kind of majoritarian, democratic, and peaceful South Africa, they were not seen as the conveners, but the whole nature of that process was direct negotiations. And in Mozambique, and this is where the question in a way comes back to you, Dave, because in some of the points that you raised earlier on, it was still mostly the leaders of the two armed groups that were actually the negotiators, and they were representatives of their factions, which had an armed political nature. Any thoughts about the broader issues of public participation in the peace negotiations, and what would have happened if other kinds of social formations, not just those linked to armed groups, had a voice in there, and what that might have done to the later peace that was reached in terms of different kind of issues that were on the agenda, different kinds of agreements that were reached? Because I think that that's sort of a different kind of role that I could also have seen the religious affiliated groups playing. What kind of a country, what kind of contents of the agreement?
Yeah, and by the way, I want to mention an excellent book on the Mozambican process by Cameron Hume, who's a U.S. diplomat, but he was invited to be present in Rome for the talks, and so he writes about the role of mediation in good offices, and he names other players in civil society and other international observers, including from Portugal and Italy and the U.S. that participated in the Rome talks. So there were other parties there, but as you know, the chapter I'm writing on Mozambique, I titled Hosts at the Table, because the religious community really did host it through the Sant'Egidio community, Catholic lay community in Rome. And the title of the chapter in Angola is Excluded from the Table, because that was their experience. And I think that is the fundamental difference beyond what the literature suggests about how we start and end peace processes. And I concede all of those political, economic, and identity reasons. I think they're quite valid. But since it's multifactorial, we need to get civil society in there as well in a clearer way, because there are now multiple case studies that demonstrate, if we exclude them, and you taught me this, then the likelihood of a successful, sustainable peace drops significantly. Carolyn or Caroline?
Well, you kind of answered my question. I wanted to ask more, maybe I would need to read this book, about what you know about the process that this group used in Rome. If you could speak a little bit about that.
Well, it was a deeply spiritual process because it was being hosted by a Catholic community. They began every day with prayers. They didn't force people to participate in them, but that was part of their life together as a community, and they invited that. And according to Bishop Singolani, who was not there for most of the talks, but a Catholic archbishop was from Beda, but he had daily reports from him, there were often times where they would stop and pray because that's what the mediators thought should happen. That never would happen in a UN process. And does it make a difference? Yeah. Probably just stopping makes a difference. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Dave. I'm just wondering if I may dare to push this out beyond the case point, the case study that you used. What kind of reflections do you have in the face of your own case study as you think about what's happening in Syria right now?
Oh, my. I will again look to my colleagues, student and faculty, for anybody who wants to respond to this. My own response is, it reminded me in a much more dramatic way of what happened in Northern Ireland when initially there were peaceful protests by the Catholic community, by the nationalist community, simply demanding fair housing and other kind of rights. When they were met on Bloody Sunday with military force and 13 people were killed, a movement that had been entirely nonviolent turned violent overnight. Now, of course, it happened in Syria again and again and again, that nonviolent protest was met with violence and eventually became completely violent and is now arguably a full-blown civil war with some religious overtones and manipulation of religious identity again. So I don't know. I'd love to hear someone else respond to the what about Syria question. The mistakes were made a year ago when they brutally, violently struck down a nonviolent protest movement. Anybody want to respond to Syria, please?
Maybe not on Syria, but in Syria case, there was many other international factors involved. Of course, many intelligence community was financing the protest in different ways. Russian was sticking to it. So there was official channels and also backdoor support for the protesters, and still it might continue for a while. But I have a question on a Mozambique case that a religious community played kind of a better successful role on bringing people together. But basically, as I get from your presentation, that there was less, like Mozambique lacks the resources. There was no international support to finance war. And then, of course, the religious circus played a relatively better role. But basically I see that the main factors of conflict are missing in Mozambique. So people were, generally there is a consensus that, okay, war is not working and there is nothing to fight for. Of course, there are some levels of success for the churches. But in case we consider those countries that right now has resources, they are international supporters who are financing war, and there are many different factors that can add to any conflict. It could be civil war or insurgency whatsoever. So I just want to know, in case that we have all the factors, and especially in many countries, I see that religion itself is a power player and stuck with the political power. So approaches with negotiations and another non-violence way sounds very unlikely to it. I don't know, but But maybe a different way to peace might be the right solution. But I like to hear more from you what you think.
Well, you nuanced the Syria situation appropriately. There are a number of outside actors, and the UN Security Council was impotent in part because two countries would have voted against any resolution. There's no question when we study the history of Latin America, Africa, many parts of Asia, and the Middle East, that outside money and arms have made a bad situation much worse. And I think our country and the Soviet Union and many others have much to repent of. I'll tell you this. When I was in Angola in 97, I was doing a training organized by Search for Common Ground. They had a number of brilliant participants, 25 participants in Luanda. We were chatting in Portuguese, and in the middle of a session, a fellow named Thomas from UNICEF in Luanda said, "You know, you Americans have this figured out." "What's that?" He said, "Well, first you provide the arms to keep us fighting each other, and then you send the peace builders to try to negotiate peace, and you get paid both times." Well, what are you supposed to do with that critique? It's absolutely true. So we talked about the reality that outside influences can worsen a situation on the peace-building end sometimes, as well as clearly on the arms end. And that's why Lisa Shirk and others have said we need to work for change in our country. The military-industrial complex is our biggest challenge here. And how do we change that?
Last one.
Okay.
Just quickly, you were talking about outside or external players versus internal players, and Catherine mentioned the role of social capital formations that can exert that agency for peaceful transition. Can you tell us anything about the women? Any anecdotes, anything about, any comparative sort of commentary on the role that gender had in this equation?
Yeah, we don't have quite the same scintillating story that Lema Boy tells from Liberia, where Muslim and Christian women organized en masse to pressure the parties. But when I was talking particularly with the two women in Mozambique that you saw pictured, both of them said there was incredible and increasing pressure from the women to the parties, albeit church parties they were talking about, that they had to take leadership for peace. They said, "We wanted the church leaders to step forward and lead for peace." And I'm convinced personally, can't measure it, that that was a big piece of why it was successful. Bishop Singolani couldn't stand the death, and I think he couldn't live with himself if he did nothing given what people were asking for. This is a drawback, though, of my being a male interviewer and primarily male religious leaders, that my contact people arrange for me to interview. So I have the stories that I have given the identity that I have.
Thanks very much, Dave, for a really stimulating talk and for the good work you did last year.